Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehr today. New York City neighborhoods are always changing, and these days that often has the look of gentrification. New housing developments, boutique small businesses, and new residents unpacking moving trucks while former residents slip out of sight and into history. The word gentrification comes from gentry, like the gentleman. It's all about class. It basically means when the fancy people move in with more money and they change a neighborhood. But in this week's New York Magazine, architecture critic Justin Davidson asked that we look at those changes and consider that maybe they might not all be bad. Done the right way, a wave of higher-income residents could be an effective way to improve a neighborhood for everyone. Are you skeptical? We'll also be taking your calls about the view from your neighborhood. But first, let me welcome Justin Davidson of New York Magazine. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So let's pick apart your argument about gentrification to start. I mean, we've just come through this election year. We're talking about a tale of two cities. Who are the winners in New York City and who are the losers? And gentrification has been one of the primary frames through which we talk about that. So why did you decide to write this piece?
Well, for just that reason. I mean, it's acquired a kind of moral charge, and the process has, and so has the word. So I wanted to kind of get into the nitty-gritty of it and try to see how it actually works and what the alternatives are and what the effects are.
So listeners, what are you seeing in your neighborhood when it comes to gentrification? What have been the upsides of new residents moving into where you live? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And we want to hear from long-timers and newcomers. If you've been in your neighborhood for decades, what have you seen about change done right? If you're new to a neighborhood, how are ways you're trying to make your sort of entry into the neighborhood fit in with what's existed? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. So what's the argument for gentrification, Justin?
Well, first of all, I'd like to make a distinction. I'm not arguing that wealthier people moving into a neighborhood bring benefits with them, although in some cases that's true, but that's not the thrust of what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that there is an alternative kind of process which results in gentrification, but which is slower and starts from the ground up. That is, it starts locally through community building. Things that we don't object to because they seem so rooted and indeed are, wind up producing a lot of the same effects as gentrification coming in from outside. So, however, I think that there are good and bad versions of that, and it has to do with how well the benefits are spread out throughout a community when a neighborhood does change, and also how fast it goes. So when you have, community organizations like in Bedford-Stuyvesant that I write about in the article, trying to cultivate the, economic health of the neighborhood, that is ultimately going to be something that is going to attract people from outside the neighborhood because the neighborhood has more to offer.
And you make the argument that in a lot of ways, if you look through the quality of life lens or the neighborhood improvement lens, gentrification looks different. You've got a great quote from a woman named Nancy Bieberman who runs the Women's Housing and Economic Development Corporation in the Bronx. And she says the same thing that low-income people think are nice are the same thing that wealthy people want when they move into a neighborhood. So if it's a gentrifying neighborhood, it's a nicer neighborhood.
Yeah, I don't think you can look at the goals of local community activists and the goals of gentrifiers in terms of what they want out of a neighborhood, what it means to have a nice neighborhood, and really see a stark difference. I think there is a convergence of interests. The problem has to do with the economics of it, and I don't want to minimize that. That is serious displacement does happen. But I think it's important that we define gentrification as separate from the process of displacement in which current residents are forced out. That does happen, but it doesn't have to happen, and it doesn't always happen. I mean, the ur example of gentrification in New York is Soho, and that was largely a product of turning an industrial neighborhood, which was not primarily residential, into a residential one. And we've seen that happen many times over. That also has effects, but it doesn't always mean gentrification. There's excuse me, it doesn't always mean displacement. It's often the case that gentrification brings new development, which adds to the housing stock. In other cases, it doesn't. When you see the most, probably the greatest kind of displacement is when you have a neighborhood of brownstones, for instance, in which you might have two or three families living. The brownstone's been cut up into apartments, although it wasn't originally intended for that. And, you know, one family buys that brownstone, and you now have fewer people living in it. And those people have to go somewhere. Part of the problem with trying to really get your arms around this issue is we don't have a lot of good information about how much that happens and when it does happen, where those people go. And that's a really big gap in our understanding of the process.
One of the arguments you make repeatedly in your piece is that the pace of change matters a lot, and whether that the change is able to be integrated into the neighborhood as it was. You're also saying that when it comes from local neighborhood activists who are trying to improve their neighborhood, improve their blocks, and then that draws more investment from outside, that's a good thing. But are you saying when it's drawn primarily from outside developers, that's when there's gentrification is still a bad thing?
You know, if you define success in neighborhood change by a rise in real estate prices, then there's a lot of pressure to make it fast because people want to be able to cash in because developers want to realize their investment. And you also get traumatic change. Sometimes the city will step in with large scale or, you know, very in-depth zoning changes, which have a lot of different effects. But one of the effects is often, you know, you take an industrial area and zone it for residential. That creates a lot of value and that brings a lot of real estate investment. And that can be dramatic and it can be traumatic. It's hard to get that right. But the reason that the pace matters is that people have an investment in the status quo. If you live in a neighborhood, you feel like you have the right to live there. And you have a certain comfort level there. And the demographics of the neighborhood have a certain identity. And people have a feeling of allegiance to that. They want to preserve it. They're not thinking necessarily, oh, well, it wasn't always this way. Therefore, it won't always stay this way. So stretching the process out means that, you know, there's a more natural, organic pace of change. And it doesn't mean that in the course of 10 years, you know, there's a really grinding changeover in the demographics.
I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer today. This is WNYC FM, HD, and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We're getting lots of calls on this. I'm going to go to David in Brooklyn first. When you hear that gentrification has some upsides, does that ring true for you and where you live in Brooklyn?
Hello?
Yeah, you there, David?
Oh, yeah, no. Well, I see it's an abomination what's happened to African-Americans in Brooklyn. Over the last 20 years, first there was thousands of predatory loan lenders who were giving poor black folks refinancing their houses, giving them shady loans. And all of a sudden, 6 months later, the property stolen right from under them. So a lot of these people moving into Brooklyn have purchased houses and buildings from the black middle class. And now these middle-class people have been pretty much dislocated, kicked out. And I'll tell you, many of these predatory lenders and people that end up with the houses are Hasidic Jews. In Brooklyn, Hasidic Jews own almost all the property in their poor neighborhoods. They're sitting on over $1 trillion worth of property. Now that Brooklyn is now becoming like Manhattan, these Hasidic Jews are evicting people right and left.
All right, David. Thanks for your call. Concern about African Americans being moved out in Brooklyn. Andrew in East Harlem, what are you seeing in your neighborhood? You there, Andrew?
Me?
Yeah, there you are, Andrew. What are you seeing in East Harlem?
Well, not too long ago, gentrification actually pushed out a Botanica that had been on 104th Street for 58 years. About five other small businesses on 104th and Lex had to be pushed out because the landlord wanted higher rents. And if you look at that strip now, a couple years later, that strip is completely, almost completely abandoned. And so I think that that's one thing that's not really mentioned in the piece, the level of, I guess there's an attempt in the piece to find a happy medium, that there's this sweet spot that we can hit with gentrification. But there's a conflating of the term gentrification and development. Gentrification requires displacement. Development doesn't necessarily have to lead to displacement. And I think that that conflating is difficult because a synonym of development is progress. So when we're saying that gentrification is equivalent to development, if I'm against development, if I'm against gentrification, then I'm against progress. Our communities aren't against progress. We are for progress that doesn't hinge on our removal to be successful. Gentrification's progress is based on increasing property value. But if you live in New York City where 70% of New York residents rent, if you live in a city, in a community like mine in El Barrio where 93.6% of the residents rent, doing everything we can as a city to increase property value is going to increase rent. It's going to lead to our displacement. We're incentivizing that process.
Thanks.
And just one tax break alone, the 421A tax abatement, New York City subsidizes luxury development to the tune of over $1 billion a year.
Thanks for your call, Andrew. You want to respond to that, Justin?
There were a lot of issues in both of those, so it's I'm not sure which part of it to respond to exactly. I mean, I agree with a lot of what both callers said. I think it's important that we define gentrification as separate from displacement. I don't think that the two things – I don't think it's helpful because displacement has a particular dynamic. I would agree with Andrew that if we allow neighborhood change to be driven exclusively by the mechanisms of trying to constantly force up real estate values, which is in the interests of, you know, developers and in some cases of policymakers, that is a toxic process and that we need to be able to manage that. When Andrew makes the distinction between gentrification and development, I think what he's saying is that there is a way to develop the quality of life in a neighborhood without leading to some of the worst aspects of gentrification. And I think that's true. But I don't think you can separate them quite so easily. I mean, I think the reality is that if you make a neighborhood more desirable, more pleasant to live in the ways that benefit the people locally, it's also going to attract people from outside who are going to see those benefits and bring in money. That's a cycle I don't think we can break. And I'm not really sure that we want to, because I think that there are unintended consequences of doing so. I think what we can try to do is manage that process by increasing the levels of affordable housing, by sort of locking in a lot of the benefits, by spreading them as widely as possible within a neighborhood so that we can mitigate that process rather than trying to stop it or fight it or block it, because I think that that's basically a losing battle. If I could just give you one example, you know, if there's one thing that all neighborhoods want is good schools, but and nobody should be stopped from trying to improve the schools. In fact, I don't think anybody really would argue that any neighborhood is better off with worse ones. But the schools, the quality of the schools is probably the one thing that will keep a gentrifying family from moving into a low-income neighborhood. It's the one thing that might persuade them to move to the suburbs or to stay where they are. You improve the schools in a neighborhood, of course people are going to look at that neighborhood again and say, well, maybe I can live there, and that is going to produce gentrification. So do you not improve the schools in order not to produce gentrification? I just don't see the logic in that.
You also make the argument that in some cases gentrification, new residents with more disposable income, is good for the existing small businesses. And you introduce us to a character named Manny Ramirez. He runs a pharmacy up in Inwood, and we have Mr. Ramirez here. Are you there, Manny?
Anna, yes, I am.
Hi. So I want to ask you about your experience in Inwood and when you realized that the neighborhood changing might work and might be good for your business.
Well, I was born and raised in Inwood, and I've been active for many decades. And the Inwood changed a couple of times. And most recently, in 2007, when I purchased Dicta Pharmacy, I decided that there's a bright future. The brand of pharmacy that I have is a little bit different and very community based. So I see a great future here as long as, you know, as a business owner, I keep in touch with the people who are here.
And how have you done that? I mean, how have you made your pharmacy a shared social space? Because I live in Crown Heights, and there are old businesses, there are new businesses, and there are very few businesses where there's old and new residents shopping together. How have you made it your shop an accommodating place for both old and new residents?
Well, it was part of my business plan to include the entire neighborhood. We opened a old-school soda shop where we serve ice cream and baked goods and make sandwiches. And we keep the price affordable. The model that I use is there's a customer I know who two families joined together, and they have between them six children. And right as I opened, they came in, and they all had ice cream, and it was an affordable bill. And in New York City, that's difficult to find. So immediately I realized that that's what I need to do. I need to make sure that small families, big families, individuals can afford to shop here, and I can also sustain the business because the bottom line, like the callers were talking about, you have to pay your rent, you have to pay your bills. My primary focus is to be a businessman in this neighborhood for decades to come.
And as a longtime Inwood guy, when you say the way the neighborhood is changing is working for me as a businessman, is that a popular opinion among folks you've known for a long time in the neighborhood?
Well, Inwood has rallied behind me 100%. If it wasn't for the Inwoodians here now, I would never still be open. We had a fire 2 years ago, and they just came, helped rebuild my pharmacy, and it's important to include them in that. As far as their opinion, what I do is I go back to when I went to school. We had to take an oath as a pharmacist, and I actually pulled it up. And my oath is to apply my knowledge, experience, and skills to the best of my ability to assure optimal drug therapy outcomes for the patients that I serve. And if those are the patients that are here, that's my obligation. I took an oath for that.
Huh, for all the patients in the neighborhood. Well, Manny Ramirez, thanks so much for joining us. Justin Davidson, one of the things that you point out in your piece that I was surprised by is the lack of good data about what actually happens in terms of displacement, like when gentrification and rising rents actually lead to longtime residents moving out and where they go.
There are two aspects to that, and one is that the process by which people move and the reasons that they move are inherently complex and resistant to collection of data. And if I could just give one example from Inwood, when you see gentrification, you're often talking about high-priced businesses, businesses that are expensive to patronize. You're also talking about ethnic change, kind of a turnover in the demographics. But if you look at Inwood specifically, the most expensive businesses are restaurants and bars that are, have a liquor-based business. La Marina is one, which are very popular in the existing Dominican and Hispanic communities. They're sort of, in some cases, they're oriented towards that population. And in fact, with the Casa La Marina, which is a restaurant on the Hudson River right at the end of Dyckman Street, the objections in terms of the noise and the traffic and all the things that that kind of gentrification brings, the objections to that are being voiced in large part by the gentrifiers west of Broadway who are not Latin. So, the one reason that the data is hard to come by is because it's very hard to capture that kind of dynamic. Hmm. But there's another aspect which is just has to do with the way that data is collected and the sample size. What we're really interested in when we talk about gentrification is at the neighborhood level. We want to know in a given collection of blocks how many people are moving in, how many people are moving out, what they're paying in rent, what their income is, what race they are. We have very granular data about, race. And in New York City, we have very good data, thanks to Joe Salvo, the demographer at the City Planning Department. Very good data on, country of origin for immigrants. And we have good data for rents. All that stuff is difficult to put together. And when you're talking about people moving from one area to another, it's very difficult to track those patterns because they sort of fall off the map. If somebody leaves the city, we lose track of them statistically.
And so we're getting lots of calls here. Gentrification is more unpopular than popular amongst our callers, as you might imagine. Bob in Brooklyn, though, you've got a different take. You live in Lefferts Gardens?
That's correct. I've lived there for almost 40 years.
And what's been your experience with neighborhood change in that part of Brooklyn?
Well, to some degree, there's been less change than you might imagine. Prospect Lefferts Gardens has been a middle-class neighborhood since it was built up, starting in the late 19th century. When I moved here in 1974, the neighborhood certainly had suffered from what was then called white flight, but that had stopped, and a fairly large percentage of white residents had remained, although they were a minority. And when I bought my house in 74, the area was attracting young people who might be called gentrifiers today, young people of all races. I also have trouble with the word gentrification, but that's another discussion.
Did you consider yourself, did you have a bit of, sort of shame around the question of whether you were gentrifying the neighborhood when you moved in 40 years ago?
When I moved in, absolutely not. In fact, demographically, I think the highest income people in the neighborhood were the generation of black, mostly West Indian residents who had bought houses some years before me. The young white and black people moving in generally were teachers, civil servants, and so on. And the older homeowners were college presidents, lawyers, doctors, and so on. So we certainly weren't displacing anyone economically. My neighborhood, the central part of my neighborhood, Lefferts Manor, where I live, has one-family zoning and deed covenants. So I wasn't displacing anyone. The row houses in the rest of the neighborhood are mostly one- and two-family, so there really hasn't been a lot of displacement.
All right. Well, Bob, thanks for your call. So you sound pretty comfortable with the change that's happened in your part of Brooklyn. One more call, Lumiere in Harlem. How do you feel about the change in the neighborhood where you live?
Hi, I'm in Harlem, and I'm a 66-year-old senior citizen that is actually going through the gentrification, and it has been horrendous. This is not a good thing, and he wants to define this word as anything other than genocide. It should be thus, because I have suffered in a building where they have renovated it with the citizens inside it. And I have come forward. I've been poisoned. I've had leaks. I have ceilings fallen in. I've had gas taken away from me since June 13th. The developers come in and they take the people out by any means possible, and the courts protect them. And this is the truth. But I'm saying to everybody, we have hope. We have a new administration. I went to the Borough Hall meeting past Monday with Gail Brewer. She's working on an app that will let people know about how much of these rent-stabilized apartments are lost. And by the way, I'm in a rent-stabilized apartment. We've lost all of those. So you keep talking about getting more. They keep pushing us out, and these things keep going up. This is all by the criminal Jews that have done...
Oh, Lumiere, thanks for your call. We're not going to go in that direction at all. Justin Davidson, you want to continue? You have something to say?
Yeah, and I had meant to get back also to the first caller we had from Brooklyn who was talking about predatory lenders and the difficulties in holding on that homeowners had in holding on to their property, especially in low-income African-American communities. This and what the last caller described about pressure from landlords to move and the vulnerability of people in rent-stabilized apartments. These are all facts. I don't argue with them at all. And I think that those are all things that we need to tackle. The It's precisely because there are so many pressures from the sort of fast-moving, economically based real estate driven kind of gentrification that I think that we need to recognize when we see it, an alternative kind of gentrification that can spread the benefits and mitigate the worst sides of it. I mean, I think that's really important.
You make the argument, though, that gentrification works best in neighborhoods that were politically organized prior to the real estate boom. And so it seems like the most disenfranchised neighborhoods, the neighborhoods that have struggled the longest, are set up, again, to be the biggest victims of gentrification.
Well, it's a little double-edged. When you have, part of the article is about Bed-Stuy, which has the oldest comprehensive community development organization in the country. It was founded in 1967 by local residents, promoted by Robert F. Kennedy and Senator Javits, so it had a lot of political clout behind it. That didn't prevent it at that time and for the next, 10, 20 years from having a lot of troubles with drugs and disinvestment and depopulation. And it's also not preventing it from becoming rapidly gentrified now. In fact, what you could say, I think this is the double edge of this, is that when you have organized, politically astute local help, local organization, you're actually doing the things that will promote gentrification. I mean, the goal of Bed-Stuy restoration is to promote the economic development of the main commercial corridors there, especially Fulton Street, try to bring in some better stores and, try to give it a more rich and vibrant economy. Well, that's pretty difficult to distinguish from gentrification. But I think that you need it. You need that, and you also need that same organization to try to manage the process of gentrification so it doesn't get out of control.
And as far as how to manage that, that's what I kept looking for, because you quote Brad Lander in your piece, the councilman, who talks about tempering gentrification in some neighborhoods. But how? What's the policy lever?
Well, so it's very clear that one of the things that really helps is an effective affordable housing program. We have a large affordable housing program. We have for a long time. Clearly, it's limited in its impact. One reason it's limited, and I think the last caller alluded to that, is that there are regulations that expire. And so apartments aren't getting decontrolled. I think we need to revisit that. We need to make a lot more of the affordability regulations permanent so that people don't feel like they're vulnerable once those things expire. But even if there were some untapped source of money that suddenly started gushing towards the city and we could build much more new affordable housing and impose rent regulations if the politics suddenly materialized to be able to do that on large parts of the city, we still wouldn't be solving the problem, because the fundamental problem is a housing shortage in New York. And the only way to deal with that is to build a lot more housing. I mean, it's fairly obvious. And we can't subsidize all the new housing that we need to build. So I would think that policy should be focused on trying to build market rate housing in areas that will not automatically become luxury housing. We used to build, in the 1940s, there are a lot of middle class buildings that went up all over Brooklyn, many parts of Manhattan, the Bronx, and Queens, all over the place, to house middle-class families. We need to try to find a way to do that, to prime the market to make that possible.
And to make market rate not feel like luxury rates, which is something many, many New Yorkers struggle with. There's a lot here, because this is about where we live and who gets to call New York City home. Thank you for adding this to the debate, Justin Davidson. You can read his piece in this week's New York Magazine, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll talk to former NYPD Commissioner Bernard Carrick about his time in prison and why he's now a prison reform advocate. I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer.